So the exciting thing about this week is that the second book of Maccabees is a lot more of an interesting book. And we're going to talk about this a bit more later, but it's much more biblical. It's much more kind of a classic, exciting story. Last week, we only looked at the first two chapters of the first book of Maccabees, because honestly, after that, it gets very, very, very boring. Very quickly, it's just military battles. Not much color, not much excitement, but the second book of Maccabees is a much more classically biblical work. People have argued that it's crafted intentionally to be far more modeled after a biblical work than the first book of Maccabees ever tried to be. But what I actually want to look at, first of all, is source number one. And there's a couple of important things to note here. You'll see, first of all, that it's actually a quotation from the second chapter of the second book of Maccabees, verse 19. So we're in the middle of the second chapter already. And then we read the following. The story of Judas Maccabeus and his brothers and the purification of the great temple and the dedication of the altar and further the wars against Antiochus, yada, yada, yada. Verse 22, regained possession of the temple, famous throughout the world, liberated the city, all those sorts of things. Verse 23 is key. All this, which has been set forth by Jason of Cyrene in five volumes, we shall attempt to condense into a single book. And then they have a couple more verses explaining the challenge of turning a large work into a smaller work. Verse 26, for us who have undertaken the toil of abbreviating, it is no light matter, but calls for sweat and loss of sleep. And then verse 32, the final verse of chapter 2. At this point, therefore, let us begin our narrative without adding any more to what has already been said, for it would be foolish to lengthen the preface while cutting short the history itself. So there's a couple of absolutely important things to note already from the beginning of the story. The first is that this is an abridged book by Jason of Cyrene. We don't know who authored the second book of Maccabees, but what we know is that they were working with something else. Jason of Cyrene. Jason is a very popular name in this period of time. Also important to already note, Jason of Cyrene clearly has Hellenist influences because he's known as Jason, which is also an important thing we'll return to a little bit later. But you'll have this huge volume, five-volume work that has now been condensed into this one volume, 15-chapter work. And it's going to be an abridgment. And indeed, if you take a look quickly at source number two, the final verses of the work. This then is how matters turned out with Nicanor. And from that time, the city has been in possession of the Hebrews. So I will here end my story. And then he has a couple of covering himself. And here will be the end. So what's also very clear from the end is that it's clear that the five volume work went on. He just chooses to end once Jerusalem is now once again in possession of the Jewish people. He's like, I've done my work. I've kind of like what I did in the first week where I summarized the history. Once I got enough past the Hanukkah story and there was still so much more to go, it's like, we've learned enough for our purposes. Let's just kind of skip the rest. He basically does the same thing here. There's his five volume work. He's summarized as much as he needs to, but now he's done. So a really important thing to know, and we know nothing else about Jason of Cyrene. But what we know is that this work is an abridgment of another work, which makes it also so much more historical in a sense, because he's taking someone else's work and deciding what to keep in and what to take out, but he's actually working from another text. The second key thing that we'll talk about a little later on is the fact that we are starting here at chapter 2, verse 19. What comes before it? So what's very clear is what comes before it are two letters. We're going to look at one of them. The other one is way too wacky to even spend time talking about. But they're both similar in point of view. Two letters. We'll talk more about this later. That are clearly and obviously tacked on. They were not originally part of the second book of Maccabees. These letters were added on by someone else and included in the book. So the true story, the true second book of Maccabees begins right here. Verse 19, chapter 2. And what we're going to see is that the second book of Maccabees could not be more different from the first. Admittedly, we didn't look too much at the first in detail, but that's because outside of those first two chapters, there's not so much to really take interest in. It's just lots and lots of battles. There's some, you know, it's just not so exciting. It's very historical. It's very dry. And the focus is solely on the Maccabim. They are the heroes. We saw last week, Matityahu is the central character, the central hero. All who follow after him take up his mantle of heroism. He is the focus of the story. Not so much with the Book of Maccabees. And to see that take, the second Book of Maccabees, and to see that take a look at source number three. While the holy city was in, and this is basically the beginning of the story, because we had the preface, which was chapter two, and now we get, oh, we're going to begin the story. So you'll remember that the story kind of began in the first Book of Maccabees with Antiochus oppressing people and Matityahu coming to the fore. This is how the story begins here. While the holy city was inhabited in unbroken peace, and the laws were strictly observed because of the piety of the high priest Onias and his hatred of wickedness, it came about that the kings themselves honored the place and glorified the temple with the finest presents, even to the extent that King Seleucus of Asia defrayed from his own revenues all the expenses connected with the services of the sacrifices. So I mentioned in the first week Onias, Chonio, Onias III, the true Kohen Gadol of ours, of the story. He is deposed, that person is deposed, and then basically his family never take the high priesthood in Yerushalayim after this point. What we already get a very clear indication of is one of the other heroes of the story. Here is Onias. He's pious. We get this wonderful elaboration that, you know, Seleucus himself is basically paying, you know, the expenses needed for the Beit HaMikdash. That is how highly esteemed Onias Chonio is. And this is the first clue of something we're going to talk about a bit more. The Beit HaMikdash, the temple, the Kohanim are much more central characters in this story. While the Maccabim are obviously also going to be major, and we'll talk a bit more about how heroic, but nonetheless are the heroes of the story, this book is far less focused on them and focuses just as much on other aspects of the Hanukkah story and puts far more emphasis on the Beit HaMikdash and those who serve it. And the best example is this absolutely amazing story right at the beginning. I put basically, I think I actually still ellipsed it at some point, but it's amazing to read in full. So let's read it in full, source number four. So we're talking about Onias, and what we're talking about is Heliodorus has been sent by the king to sack the Beit HaMikdash, to take some money, to steal things from the Beit HaMikdash for revenue. 22. While they were calling upon the Almighty Lord that he would keep what had been entrusted safe and secure for those who had entrusted it, Heliodorus went on with what had been decided. But when he arrived at the treasury with his bodyguard, then and there the sovereign of spirits and of all authority caused so great a manifestation that all who had been so bold as to accompany him were astounded by the power of God and became faint with terror. For there appeared to them a magnificently caparisoned horse with a rider of frightening mien. It rushed furiously at Heliodorus and struck at him with its front hoofs. Its rider was seen to have armor and weapons of gold. Two young men also appeared to him, remarkably strong, gloriously beautiful and splendidly dressed, who stood on either side of him and flogged him continuously, inflicting many blows on him. When he suddenly fell to the ground and deep darkness came over him, his men took him up, put him on a stretcher, and carried him away. This man, who had just entered the aforesaid treasury with a great retinue and all his bodyguard, but was now unable to help himself. They recognized clearly the sovereign power of God. While he lay prostrate, speechless because of the divine intervention and deprived of any hope of recovery, they praised the Lord who had acted marvelously from his own place. And the temple, which a little while before was full of fear and disturbance, was filled with joy and gladness now that the Almighty Lord had appeared. Some of Heliodorus's friends quickly begged Onias to call upon the Most High to grant life to one who was lying quite at his last breath. So the high priest, fearing that the king might get the notion that some foul play had been perpetrated by the Jews with regard to Heliodorus, offered sacrifice for the man's recovery. While the high priest was making an atonement, the same young men appeared again to Heliodorus, dressed in the same clothing, and they stood and said, "Be very grateful to the high priest Annas, since for his sake the Lord has granted you your life. And see that you who have been flogged by heaven report to all the majestic power of God." Having said this, they vanished. This story, which happens right at the beginning, has a whole bunch of important things. Again, the center is the Beit HaMikdash. God, front and center. I mentioned last week how God is, and we're going to see God is referenced in the first book of Maccabees, but not as explicitly. God here is a central character, just like he is in the Torah. He is performing miracles, which is also something far less clearly explained in the first book of Maccabees. In first book of Maccabees, we don't get these explicit miracles, but here, this is about as miraculous as you can get. And not only do we have God, not only do we have God saving the people, but it is all through the merit of Chonio, of Onias. He is, we are told before anything else, he is a hero in this story. He has tremendous power. He is chosen by God, and he can, you know, basically through him, God will beat up his enemies, and then he asks God to save them, and once again, he will do so. This idea that Onias is just the continuation of many of the biblical heroes comes to the fore very much here. And this is one of the main differences between the second book of Maccabees and the first book of Maccabees. First book of Maccabees cares about the Beit HaMikdash, but not in the same sense. Doesn't mention Chonio or Onias. And it makes sense, because if you think about the point of the first book of Maccabees is to explain why the Chashmonaim were able to take the high priesthood, the last thing you would start your story with is talking about how the true high priest was, you know, this guy. It doesn't make sense. So it already gives us a clue as to what exactly is the motive behind the second book of Maccabees. But the point here is that Chonio, Onias, the Beit HaMikdash, these are all central characters. We're going to skip a lot of, again, the historical book talked about in the second book of Maccabees, because it's just, we've talked about it before. And instead, I want to touch on a few different key themes that come out in the second book of Maccabees that also really contrast with the key themes of the first book of Maccabees. So I mentioned last week how the Hasidim, the from people, for want of a better expression, are not the heroes in the first book of Maccabees. They are not looked at particularly positively. Again, they were murdered for refusing to defend themselves on Shabbat, and it's very clear that Matityahu, as much as he extremely opposes those Jews who have Hellenized, he also is not the biggest fan of the Hasidim. He's not the biggest fan of them. They are people he's trying to convince to join his cause. And so their martyrdom is not a positive thing. Their martyrdom is not something that is seen of as anything that, as a good thing. And we saw last week, and we're going to come back to it a little bit later, you can argue that Matityahu, as described in the first book of Maccabees, does not seem to believe in the resurrection of the dead. You die as a martyr, you're done, that's it, boom, there is no chance. The second book of Maccabees is very, very different. For the second book of Maccabees, these from people who were willing to lay down their lives in an act of martyrdom are also responsible for God's salvation. And we see this most clearly in chapter 7, which is maybe one of the most famous Hanukkah stories, which is the seven sons and the mother who are asked. I remember learning this story as a kid. And there is a woman and her seven sons, and they are all told to eat pork. And they refuse to, and they are killed because they would rather put down their life than violate one of the mitzvot. This is classic, you know, chassidut in the Book of Maccabees version of that term. But this is a classic willing to die rather than violate a mitzvah. The conclusion of that story is the following in source number 5. I, like my brothers, give up body and life for the laws of our ancestors, appealing to God to show mercy soon to our nation and by trials and plagues to make you confess that he alone is God. and through me and my brothers to bring to an end the wrath of the Almighty that has justly fallen on our whole nation. What's very clear here is that the act of martyrdom encourages God to bring salvation. These people willing to lay down their lives aren't dying in vain, aren't dying foolishly like the first book of Maccabees would seem to imply, but rather instead their martyrdom is what helps bring salvation. As much as the Maccabim taking up arms is responsible for repelling the Seleucid army, so too is the martyrdom of these Hasidim that too brings forth God's actions in delivering the Seleucid army to the people. Another interesting thing here is that one thing that the second book of Maccabees is very, very clear on is that the deposing of Ananias and the general casual not caring about the temple is really the big sin. In the first book of Maccabees, the big sin is Hellenism. It's these people are tempted to observe kind of, you know, a different way of life. That is what brings upon them God's wrath. In the second book of Maccabees, it's the fact that Ananias is gotten rid of. It's the fact that the temple is no longer in control of the people it should truly be in control of. That's the big sin that has brought God's wrath. Hellenism is not the big sin of the story. Rather, the big sin of the story is the deposing of Ananias. And it's only through this act of martyrdom on behalf of the Hasidim that in part can help, you know, repair the problem that has happened. So a major theme of the second book of Maccabees is that it's not just violence that brings salvation, which is really the kind of catchphrase of the first book of Maccabees, but also this act of martyrdom, this willing to lay down your life, you know, rather than accept religious prosecution to die in the name of God, that too can help bring about salvation as much as taking up arms can. Another major motif of the second book of Maccabees, and we already saw this a bit with the story of Ananias and the miracle, but we see it so explicitly, is God's direct involvement in the story. And so what I've done with sources 6 and 7 is putting two stories that are basically the same story, recounted in both the first and second book of Maccabees, next to one another, so we can gain a sense of the differences between the two. So if we first take a look at source number 6. But the next year, he, that's Lysias, mustered 60,000 picked infantry and 5,000 cavalry to subdue them. They came to Idumea and encamped at Beth-Tsor, and Yehuda met them with 10,000 men. When he saw that their army was strong, he prayed, saying, "Blessed are you, O Savior of Israel, who crushed the attack of the mighty warrior by the hand of your servant David, and gave the camp of the Plishtim in the hands of Jonathan, son of Saul, and of the man who carried his armor. Hem in this army by the hand of your people Israel, and let them be ashamed of their troops and their cavalry. Fill them with cowardice, melt the boldness of their strength, let them tremble in their destruction. Strike them down with the sword of those who love you, and let all who know your name praise you with hymns." Then both sides attacked, and there fell of the army of Lysias 5,000 men. They fell in action. When Lysias saw the rout of his troops and observed the boldness that inspired those of Yehuda, and how ready they were either to live or die nobly, he withdrew to Antioch and enlisted mercenaries in order to invade Judea again with an even larger army. So there's a few themes here. First of all, again, dry. Not particularly an exciting narrative. It's just battle, boom. The second is we do have here Yehuda praying, but it's a very militaristic prayer. God is invoked as the Savior of Israel, and he's invoking all of these military ideas. And again, if we compare again, thinking of that martyrdom, verse 35, how ready they were either to live or to die nobly. Noble death in the first book of Maccabees is you die fighting. Noble death in the second book of Maccabees is you die refusing to violate its vault. You die as a chassid in the second book of Maccabees, and that's a noble death. First book of Maccabees, the noble death is simply dying in battle. But we see this kind of very, again, God is invoked, but in very circuitous ways. and in a very kind of, you know, specific way. Take a look at source 7, which is basically, again, the same story. Very soon after this, Lysias, the king's guardian and kinsman, who was in charge of the government, being vexed at what had happened, gathered about 80,000 infantry and all his cavalry and came against the Jews. He intended to make the city a home for Greeks and to levy tribute on the temple as he did on the sacred places of the other nations and to put up the high priesthood for sale every year. Again, what's one of the big things we're worried about? The priesthood. He took no account whatever of the power of God, but was elated with his 10,000s of infantry and his thousands of cavalry and his 80 elephants. So again, he's also automatically, he does not care about God. That is very clear. Invading Judea, he approached Beit Tzur, which was a fortified place about 5 stadia from Jerusalem, and pressed it hard. When Maccabeus, that is Yehuda, and his men got word that Lysias was besieging the stronghold, they and all the people with lamentations and tears prayed the Lord to send a good angel to save God. Maccabeus himself was the first to take up arms, and he urged the others to risk their lives with him and to aid their kindred. They eagerly rushed off together, and there, while they were still near Jerusalem, a horseman appeared at their head, clothed in white and brandishing a weapon of gold. And together they all praised the merciful God and were strengthened in heart, ready to assail not only humans but the wildest animals or walls of iron. They advanced in battle order, having their heavenly ally, for the Lord had mercy on them. They hurled themselves like lions against the enemy and laid low 11,000 of them and 1,600 cavalry and forced all the rest to flee. Most of them got away stripped and wounded, and Lysias himself escaped by disgraceful flight. First point, much more interesting storytelling. Second book of Maccabees, just a much better storyteller than the first book of Maccabees. But more importantly here, whereas in the first book of Maccabees, God is invoked as a military figure. Simply, that's it. And basically, they ask God for help, and they are victorious, and that's it. No explicit connection between the two. Here, there is much more classic tefillah. Verse 6, the lamentations and tears. And they want, what do they want God to send? An angel. They want explicit, in this, from the second book of Maccabees' perspective, it's not military tactics that win the day. But it's the fact that, first of all, the people themselves are pious, that they ask God to intervene. And basically, again, this would make a great movie, because this is basically straight out of Lord of the Rings or vice versa. But basically, you have this mysterious, majestic horseman. This book loves majestic horsemen that are angels. Basically leading the charge. And that's what gets them going. There's no military tactics. There's no military brilliance. It's simply God is with them. It's much more, again, biblical. In the Torah, not the Torah, but in Tanakh. In other parts of Tanakh, we get these kinds of episodes where God or an angel of God acts as, you know, the leader of the army. And that's what we get here. So it's very clear that the second book of Maccabees wants us to clearly identify the salvation not coming through the hands of the Maccabees, as much as God, people's prayers. And what something that I didn't put down on the source sheet, but something else that you find is that the book of Maccabees makes reference to, that the Hasidim are themselves considered part of the rebels. And there is a point at which I think it is, I forget which Antiochus, he's complaining. But he's not just complaining about the Maccabim, he's complaining about the Maccabim and the Hasidim. In the second book of Maccabees, again, those Hasidim are as much a part of the rebel alliance as the Maccabim are. That's what's so clear coming through the second book of Maccabees, is this fact that the Hasidim have an equally important role to play, as does God. First book of Maccabees, it's the Maccabim alone, their violence, their military strategy is what causes them to excel. The second book of Maccabees, very different. It's much more, no. The Maccabim had a role. They were very important. Without them, this story would not have taken place. But equally important in their own way with the Hasidim. And also directing the whole thing overtly, explicitly, miraculously is God. And this basically brings us to the central question, which is, are the Maccabim heroes in this story? So what's clear is that they are no way near as heroic as the first book of Maccabees. The first book of Maccabees, they are the central characters. The second book of Maccabees, they play a role, but there are other people who are also the focus. You can't deny that it's because of the second Maccabim's uprising that leads to the Beit HaMikdash being purified, which is a very, very important thing from the perspective also of second Maccabees. But it's clear that the author of second Maccabees has a much more parav view of them. He doesn't see them as wholly good. And in general, when you think of the way the first book of Maccabees characterizes other figures, particularly Hellenists, as totally negative, the second book of Maccabees doesn't do the same thing. If you go back for a second just to source number three, we have here kind of this acknowledgement of this positive relationship between Seleucus and Chonio, that there is this idea that a foreign king can have a positive relationship with the Jewish people. This is also, as I've already mentioned, a book authored by a guy called Jason. He himself very clearly has Hellenistic influences. Whereas the first book of Maccabees goes out of its way to not write in Greek and to write in Hebrew, the second book of Maccabees was written in Greek. Again, the person who writes the second book of Maccabees has, and Jason of Cyrene himself, have much more comfort with the language of the Hellenistic world. That is much more clearly a theme.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes.
So for the first, you said there's four books of Maccabees, is that correct? Were they all written around the same time and within the time, like, were the authors, how far removed were the authors from the events?
So honestly, I know nothing about the third and fourth books of Maccabees. Okay, they are almost treated as different. Too. So the first book of Maccabees is written during the reign of Yanai, who is one of the Hashmonai kings. He's one of the first to actually declare himself truly king and Kohen Gadol. Mm-hmm. Much, much later. I forget because I don't have it with me, but he's much, much later than the Hanukkah story. We are now way removed from the Hanukkah story. Decades, if not longer.
Okay.
Maybe even a century. I completely forget. That could be completely wrong, but...
Okay.
You know.
So not... I mean, he wouldn't have known... It's all hearsay, basically.
What's very clear is that both books of Maccabees are working from legitimate documents.
Right.
That we still live in the era at this point of history. Like, it's not like...
Right.
Other parts of Tanakh, where it's before even people had a concept of history. Like, at this point, there is a concept of history. So there is a lot of verification of this story, but what's clear is that these stories are being told through specific lenses.
Right, and the people who wrote them were not the people who partook in the revolt.
Correct.
That's what I'm saying.
And yeah.
You have known firsthand or even secondhand about that. They're reading it through history.
And yes. It's unclear when Jason of Cyrene lived.
Yeah.
It's unclear how close he is to the events. Because again, if you think within the space of 100 years for a 5-volume work in those days to have been written and to have been published and to find its way into the hands of someone else who's about to edit it, that, I imagine, takes this period of time.
Right,
so.
It's a pretty quick for that period for it to be just 100 years.
But it would make sense then that Jason of Cyrene, this is me speculating, might be closer to the events because to have written all of that in that time.
Okay.
Chances are, unless this is Jason of Cyrene's next door neighbor who's abridging it now, and it's like, therefore, it can account for a lot of things.
Oh,
but
assuming.
So what's clear is that people argue the first book of Maccabees is there to justify the Hashmonai reign. To legitimize it, to show why they are correct. And what's very clear is that the second book exists to call that into question. It is not to diminish. It is to diminish the role of the Maccabim, but it's not to delegitimize the role of the Maccabim in the Hanukkah story. But it's to say that, hold on a second, they should never have been Kohen Gadol. Again, we saw last week how Pinchas is one of the models of Maccabim because he gets the kahuna. And so if they are the continuation of his zealotry, they too deserve the kahuna. But what our story begins with is Onias, who really should be the king, not the king, sorry, the Kohen Gadol in the Beit. His descendants should be the Kohen, should be the Kohenim Gadolim in the Beit HaMikdash. That's what should be the case. So it already calls into question that. We definitely get called into question also how bad the Hellenists were. Because it's been written by a guy called Jason. In this book is being written in Greek. The idea that comes up a lot is this idea that foreign leaders are good. Relationships with foreign leaders are good. Remember, the Hashmonaim declared themselves their own kingdom, and they kind of are repelling all these, you know, foreign kings. So they're only working with them as much as it's good for them. This story starts with a wonderful Kohen Gadol and a wonderful King Seleucus, who's basically paying at all the expenses of the Beit HaMikdash. It's a very, very different depiction. The Hasidim, who are kind of the, you know, they're the guys who, you know, when you're watching a movie, you're like, don't do it. Why are they such idiots? You know, you see in every movie those characters you're just supposed to like tut at as you're watching them. In the first book of Maccabees, the Hasidim are those guys. You're supposed to be like, they are dumb too. They are wrong. They should totally have fought. Second book of Maccabees raises their status to on par with the Maccabim also. And finally, we also get the righteousness of the Maccabim themselves being called into question. If you take a look at source number 8, so this is later in the story. On the next day, as it had now become necessary, Yehuda and his men went to take up the bodies of the fallen and to bring them back to lie with their kindred in the sepulchres of their ancestors. Then, under the tunic of each one of the dead, they found sacred tokens of the idols of Yamjamnia, which the law forbids the Jews to wear. And it became clear to all that this was the reason these men had fallen. So what this is portraying is that the Maccabim themselves are guilty of Avodah Zarah. They are dying because they've kind of almost adopted this extreme Hellenism. I'm assuming Jamnia is a Greek god. But the point is that the Maccabim, who are these perfect, righteous figures, boo the Hellenists, yea, the Maccabim. In this story, all of a sudden, we're calling into question their own legitimacy. That some of them, admittedly the ones who died, not the kind of the tier one, I'm using tier one and tier two again, not the tier one Maccabim, they maybe are righteous, but you know, the people with them are not necessarily as righteous as we might think. That they too are guilty. So what the second book of Maccabees is doing is it's taking the Maccabim themselves, as portrayed in the first book of Maccabees, and kind of dragging them a bit lower down. And it's taking the Hasidim and raising them up. It's making this much more a story about from people praying to God for deliverance to save the Beit HaMikdash, God weaving over miracles and, you know, using a figure who's willing to resort to violence as kind of the instrument through which he does the rebellion. But it's much less, look at these brave Maccabim who took up arms to defend everything. And it's much more, thank you, God. Let's say Hallel now. Thank you. Yes, the Maccabim in the second book of Maccabees are probably the Maccabees that we learn about in the Hanukkah story. Like the classic Hanukkah story, where these Maccabim are, you know, kind of, I mean, yeah, we have tomorrow, yeah, is Hanukkah party. So I assume I'll be learning lots about the Maccabim tomorrow in some very cute songs. These are the Maccabim in the second, I mean, apart from the shades of negative, but they're just generic good guys who happen to fight, but thank you, Hashem. You know, we say Hallel, we thank God on Hanukkah. That's why the focus, second book of Maccabees kind of wins. Between the two books of Maccabees, the second book of Maccabees ideology, we focus also, the reason we grow up with the story of like the seven sons willing to sacrifice their lives. Again, we value the martyrdom. The second book of Maccabees is really the much frummer story. It's the much more classic biblical story. We have God. We have miracles. We have frum people willing to die for their beliefs. And we happen to have some awesome dudes, you know, picking up swords and beating an army. But ultimately, they are important characters in the story, but they aren't the sole ones. And so, if you think of the Hanukkah story almost as a continuum, on one extreme of the continuum of the first book of Maccabees, which is, I mean, maybe you have the actual historical story per se, but then you have the first book of Maccabees, which is far more about the Maccabim's violent uprising and its legitimacy, which leads to their kingship, as well as them taking the high priesthood. Further along the spectrum, you have the second book of Maccabees, which turns the story far more into a from story, far more in line with Al-Hanisim. When we say the story of Al-Hanisim, when we say the story in Al-Hanisim in our Amida starting in just a few days from now, again, it's very second book of Maccabees. Even further along the spectrum, you find Chazal, who don't even validate basically this part of the story, because for them, they are so, again, it's been argued, and it's a very compelling argument, for them, their ideological heroes in this story are the Chassidim. So for them, they're never going to like the first book of Maccabees, where the Chassidim are the dumb guys. They're not the bad guys, but they're just the kind of the pointless guys in the story. The second book of Maccabees, where the Chassidim play an important role, and then Chazal kind of take that idea, the Chassidim who purified the temple, and kind of, again, make the story much more focused on the Beit HaMikdash. What we're left with now, just to talk about very, very briefly, is what actually happens at the very beginning of the first book of Maccabees. Because as we saw, the story in the second book of Maccabees very clearly and obviously begins chapter 2, verse 19, which begs the question, what is chapters 1 and chapter 2? So they are two different letters. And the second letter, all over the place. This first letter has, for reasons that make a lot of sense, but I'm not going to go over because I'm trusting the people who say these kinds of things. The first letter is very obviously a true, genuine letter. Let's look, source number 9, the letter.
So is this from First Maccabees?
Second Maccabees. This is the very beginning of Second Maccabees. Okay. You buy yourself wherever you buy it. I mean, don't buy it because it's probably going to be in a Christian Bible, so probably not worth the money. But you Google 2 Maccabees. You click 2 Maccabees. This is how it begins. The Jews in Jerusalem and those in the land of Judea, to their Jewish kindred in Egypt, greetings and true peace. May God do good to you, and may he remember his covenant with Abraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov, his faithful servants. May he give you all a heart to worship him and to do his will with a strong heart and a willing spirit. May he open your heart to his law and commandments, and may he bring peace. May he hear your prayers and be reconciled to you, and may he not forsake you in time of evil. We are now praying for you here. Before we go any further, there's two equally compelling and mutually compatible ways to analyze these first few verses. One, the Jews in Egypt are going through a bad time. Second, the authors of this letter think the Jews in Egypt are doing bad things. Pray, you know, in the one hand, it's maybe something's going wrong, so we're praying for you, but also, give you a heart to worship him, do his will with a strong heart. May he open your heart to his law and his commandments. You don't say that to someone who you have tremendous faith in their religious observance. If you ask God, please make this person observe the mitzvot, that implies they don't already do so. It clearly implies the people in Egypt are sinners. And then we get, in the reign of Demetrius, in the 169th year, this is the Seleucid count, which begins with the founding of the Seleucid Empire. It uses, for a long, long time, convention of dates becomes year one is Seleucus takes the throne. In the reign of Demetrius, in the 169th year, we Jews wrote to you, in the critical distress that came upon us in those years, after Jason and his company, this is not Jason, author of the book, but Jason, high priest opposed, who basically kicks off the whole story. After Jason and his company revolted from the Holy Land and the kingdom, and burned the gate and shed innocent blood, we prayed to the Lord and were heard, and we offered sacrifice and grain offering, and we lit the lamps and set out the loaves. And now, see that you keep the festival of booths in the month of Kislev, in the 188th year. ultimately, this letter is encouraging Jews outside the land of Israel to observe Chanukah. So there's several questions. What's going on in this letter? Why did they send it? Why was it included in the book of Maccabees? In the second book of Maccabees. Again, Jason of Cyrene does not have this letter. The author of the second book of Maccabees does not seem to have this letter because he begins his book, chapter 2, verse 19. And then the second letter is a much more dramatic telling of the Hanukkah story, but basically has the same rough theme. It's just much crazier. So we'll talk about that in a second. So first, I mentioned already, sinning. What is the sins of the Jews in Egypt? So there was a second Beit HaMikdash in Leontopolis, founded by the descendants of Onias. Chonio's descendants decide they are still going to be the Kohanim Gedolim, but because for reasons that we don't quite know, but nonetheless we can guess that, they think if they've been deposed on the Beit HaMikdash, then kind of the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash goes with them. They can think that. You could argue it. You can read certain Nevi'im to basically argue that the Beit HaMikdash itself travels. But basically they build a second Beit HaMikdash in Egypt. So what's been argued is this letter is basically talking about that. That basically you are sinning because the real Beit HaMikdash is here in Yerushalayim. And there is this tension between these two Batei HaMikdash, these two temples. One is in its true location, as it should be, but led by Kohanim, who should not be in charge of it. The second is in its incorrect location, it shouldn't be, but led by the people who should be in charge of it, and you have this tension. So the first thing is the sinning here is the worshipping of the wrong Beit HaMikdash. The second thing that's going on is political trouble. Because Ptolemy the VIII and Cleopatra the II, who are brother and sister, are basically fighting over control of Egypt. Ptolemy is basically on the cusp of winning, but the Jews had aligned themselves with Cleopatra. And so they are clearly in a bit of trouble right now politically and worried about what the consequences are going to be. What's very clear is that this letter, and the second letter even more so, is urging people to also celebrate Chanukah. That the point is that Chanukah needs to be commemorated at its correct date, and that really part of the purpose of Chanukah here is to celebrate the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. They are encouraging the Jews in Egypt to celebrate a festival that very much encourages the idea and reinforces the idea that the true Beit HaMikdash is in Yerushalayim. Not the one in Egypt. Rather, if you celebrate a festival that is central to the land of Israel, then it reaffirms exactly where, you know, the focus should be. You know, kind of, the thing that springs to mind is famously when the Reform movement removed references to the return to Israel from the tefillah, like back in Germany back in the day, because it's like, well, and it's the same reason for the calling it a temple, because right. You don't need the temple, you have the temple here. And that idea is... Yeah, but that exact thing is what's happening here, is that no, celebrate this festival here of just like nowadays, and I think famously the Reform movement was very against Zionism at the beginning, and now obviously it's become Zionistic. But regardless, the idea of celebrating when we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut nowadays, it's a reminder to everyone that there is a focus going on elsewhere. So telling the Jews in Egypt, you may think things are legitimate here, but you need to celebrate this festival surrounding the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, that's what you need to do. You picked up on the fact that it's actually Sukkot and not Hanukkah. So I think I also mentioned this in the first week, and I've definitely mentioned it in the past because I think it's the coolest fact ever, that they didn't have a chance to celebrate to do with corruptions of the calendar and to do with the military battle and a whole host of things. The 25th of Kislev is actually the 25th of Tishrei, because they lost the calendar kind of goes missing for a while, and I times of things and dates are my Achilles heel. To this day, I always call someone in the run-up to Chagim to be like, I just want to run by these numbers because, like, Zmanim times of Chagim is my Achilles heel. So like when I read like complications in the calendar, I'm just like, my brain is like, no thanks. Goodbye. Come back when you're back to military. But for whatever reason, the calendar gets messed up. And so the 25th of Kislev to the Jews in the Hanukkah story is actually they realize Tishrei, and so they celebrate Sukkot then. Hanukkah was originally Sukkot again, or Sukkot finally celebrated, and then gets turned into.
When did we switch from a strict lunar calendar like the Muslims have, where things like Ramadan occur in different seasons and rotate around the year, and we have a heliolunar calendar where,
yeah, so it is that the problem is it's much harder to do that when you're in the middle of a war, and that's basically the problem, is they lose track of the ability to kind of keep the calendar, because back then you couldn't just pull out your phone and check the date. You have to actually have people maintaining a calendar, and I imagine that's the kind of task that gets dropped the second you're facing an oppressive regime and everyone's going to war with everyone else. So part of the major point thrust of this letter is to urge the people in Egypt to celebrate Hanukkah. The question then becomes, why was the letter included? Like, why stick the letter and the second letter also before the second book of Maccabees? What's the point? Like, it's fine that we have this letter in here. It's cool. It's interesting that this was happening. But why bother including it at the beginning? So, there's a variety of different suggestions, but one really, really cool suggestion that's argued by, I looked up his name and then I forgot it again, but the author of the Anchor Bible Commentary, he makes a really cool suggestion, which I don't think is his own. I think lots of people make this suggestion. Again, the second book of Maccabees is much more biblical in nature. It's very clearly designed to be read as a biblical book in ways the first book of Maccabees is not. And if you think of the classic other book of this kind of form, you think of Megillat Esther. And Megillat Esther, at the end, chapter 9, you get this really weird point of the story where you think you're done with the story, but you get, they sent out letters. And the authority of this story rests upon the letters that were sent out to the Jews, urging them to celebrate this date, urging them to celebrate Purim. That basically, the Megillah self-testifies to the celebration of Purim. And so one argument is that Second Book of Maccabees takes a play from that playbook and is like, let's start with a letter urging the celebration of Hanukkah as a legitimate festival. And now here's the story. Whether it was intended to actually be read like Megillat Esther is, where we actually read Megillat Esther in Shul, is a good question. There are those people who do refer to the Book of Maccabees as Megillat Antiochus. Whether they mean the first book of Maccabees or second book of Maccabees, but if you had to choose one, it would be the second book of Maccabees, because, again, much more classically biblical. But there is an argument to be made that the point of these letters is basically to justify the religious significance of the story. That in some way, the second book of Maccabees was hoped to be, if not included in the canon of Tanakh, which at this point still in history is still very fluid. The canon has not yet been canonized. Tanakh has not yet been sealed. It's still very fluid. Everything's still up for grabs. So maybe they were hoping to, this was going to be another biblical book. And so this letter, which enforces the centrality of Hanukkah on all Jews, including Jews outside the land of Israel, also functions in the same way as the ending of Megillat Esther in justifying the story through a letter from major figures. And that is basically the point of, argued these point of these letters. The second letter basically does the same thing as the first, far more dramatically. It's weird. But basically it serves the same purpose. And so what we're basically left with, as the dust settles over these past few weeks, is many, many different perspectives of the Hanukkah story. We spoke the first week about the actual historical events, devoid of, God's role. And then last week we looked at the first book of Maccabees, which very clearly wants us to understand the centrality and importance of the Maccabim to the exclusion of everyone else. And as we even saw today, God gets, at best, passing reference. But then we have the second book of Maccabees, which many argue is written in response to the first, which tries to argue the complete opposite, that tries to take the main themes of the first book of Maccabees and reduce them slightly, and instead be far more classically a religious book in elevating the role of God elevating the role of miracles, elevating the role of just being quote-unquote from as a heroic character, while at the same time questioning exactly how bad Hellenism actually might be, given that this story was authored by the Book of Jason. And that's not to mention something we've talked about in the past, which is how Chazal seemed to go one step even further and just basically, I mean, not only do they not include it in the canon, they basically decide what makes it in Tanakh, and they don't put either of these in the canon, but they basically, we are left with a modern day Hanukkah, where at best we have passing mention to the kind of the second book of Maccabee's story in Al-Hanisim, but the real focus becomes the Beit HaMikdash. We all think the story of Hanukkah is a story about the, and it was the Chanukat HaMikdash, but we think the story of Hanukkah revolves around the Beit HaMikdash and the Kalim of the Beit HaMikdash, the menorah. That was the point of Hanukkah, because the battles become almost incidental. The stories of the Maccabim are heroic, but we don't dwell too much on their heroism, and instead we focus all our Hallel and Hodah on God himself, and we see this as a miracle. Just as the second book of Maccabees emphasizes the miraculous battles, Chazal take that one step further. Never mind miraculous battles, let's just do miracle inside the Beit HaMikdash. One jar of oil, it lasted 8 nights. That becomes the miracle. There's no more like the second book of Maccabees, guy riding on a horse, you know, saving everyone, or, you know, angels appearing and flogging bad people inside the Beit HaMikdash. Now instead we get a far more classic miracle of God's ability to make the impossible possible, and that reframes the whole of Hanukkah. So, in a weird way, the Hashmonaim won the battle of Hanukkah, but they didn't win the ultimate goal of their dynasty being remembered positively. Already, you look in, you know, the works of Chazal, the Hashmonaim are not positive figures. If there is any positive reflection on their ancestors, and it has paled by the time that Chazal are on the scene, and in some cases are persecuted by the Hashmonaim. The Hashmonaim do not get on well with Chazal. A classic kind of lens to explore the literature of Chazal is the tension between Chazal and the Kohanim, and Chazal and the Hashmonaim, and those kinds of things. All those tensions come to bear, and so we are left with a festival we are celebrating as Hanukkah, but a story that is so radically different from the actual story that of what happened, because it turns out in the end that that story from the perspective of Chazal just isn't worth celebrating that much. And instead, what we should be expressing our thanks to is God himself for his miracles. We see that in the second book of Maccabees. We don't see that in the first book of Maccabees. And so it's really the second book of Maccabees literally had the final word, because we're going to ignore third and fourth book of Maccabees, but it literally had the final word and basically set the tone for how we would celebrate Hanukkah to this day.